Hi, I'm Phil Williams, a North West based sea angling journalist. Today, however, I'm down in Sussex with IGFA guide Justin Anwell to record a four-part interview about his particular angling speciality, which is saltwater fly fishing for bass. In this, our second instalment, we explore the concept itself. So are there any specific advantages to be had by being based on such a large natural harbour, with two similar inlets immediately to the west of it at Portsmouth and Langston?
Strangely enough, I mean, I've never worked them. This is often the problem when you become a specialist in your area. I couldn't answer that honestly because I've never worked them. I couldn't say we've got a marginal advantage in Chichester Harbour. I know that Chichester Harbour is a very beautiful area and it's the equivalent of an SSSI. It has a number of intertidal zone bars that show themselves to you at certain stages of the tide, which are, you know, easy to access. I say easy, respectfully, you can access them knowing what you know. The guide's job, remember, is to watch your back on tide. You crack on with the fishing. Let me worry about your tide. And I think that as well as being a beautiful area to operate in, it's as safe as you could want it to be in terms of the topography and the ground is good, mussel bed, it's good, shingle, gravel, it's firm underfoot. Touch wood, we haven't had a problem there. And I think as a first stage to being introduced to it, I mean, we've got clients this week which are coming in for the first time. They generally want to wade, and to get them into an isolated environment in the middle of what seems to be the open sea wading for fish is a thrill for them anyway. But in terms of is it any better than anywhere else, I would say that the south coast isn't the best ground for quality fish. I think you need structured ground. You know, knowing what I know now, I mean, if I venture over to the Isle of Wight and travel west, they have what we haven't got. We've got an intertidal alluvial floodplain. They have 100 foot or 60 or 80 foot within 100 foot cast, especially on the north facing side. And they've also got the element of a prevailing wind on the east side being very sheltered. So their clarity of water usually on the prevailing wind is absolutely cracking. Unlike with us, where we are always reverse hauling because we're always faced with the wind coming on the right hand side. So if you're a right hooker, you're going to naturally migrate your technical part of your cast to a reverse haul. Otherwise, you're going to be hooking yourself in your right ear. So I would say it's more testing here, but it is an area that I've got to explore. It has offered up some fantastic opportunities for people coming in. I think as you've got to remember, it's like manufacturing a fishing rod. I don't manufacture a fishing rod for me. I manufacture a fishing rod for somebody else. Or I don't manufacture what I can use. So when it comes to a school, you're actually trying to introduce people to an area which may not be the best area, but it's the best training ground for them. I'm expecting my clients to move from the training ground into using the information and going back to where they came from and putting that into practice. They may well have better ground than me, but in order to build their confidence, I think it's a superb place to do that.
To flesh that out a little bit more now, what is it that you and your clients, who may later go their own way, should be looking for in terms of ideal bass habitat?
Well, I mean, certainly I think the first thing you've got to look for is you've got to look for ground which is being disturbed by water flow. If you went to an estuary, for instance, what is an estuary? Well, an estuary is a gaping great hole in landmass, which will have a restricted tidal flow in it, which will give you tidal flow, tidal current. Bass is a highly expedient hunter, and it will work on the basis of what I call marginal advantage. So it will wait for food to be presented to it. If it doesn't have to hunt, it won't hunt. So when you look at looking for an opportunity to present a line, then let's look for an area of water which is disturbed by either landmass or tidal flow, one of which usually works in unison with one another. And an estuary would be a perfect place to start. Once you've isolated where you think tidal flow will be offered, then you need to probably go and approach that mark in a very big tide, but probably not with a fly rod to start with. So take a digital camera. Perfect these days to just take digital content. When I look at areas, I actually use Google Earth to isolate darker ground, deeper ground, or areas that may not be as very obvious to you when you're right in front of them. Sometimes you can't see the woods or the trees, but certainly to isolate darker arteries of water and to take shots of an area on low water spring, which will give you the backbone of what you are working over, maybe at mid-flood or mid-ebb. I haven't found there's a tremendous amount of difference between working in tidal flow, ebbing or flooding, which we'll probably go on to a little bit later. Some marks work on flood, some marks work on ebb. But generally speaking, if you've got tidal flow, you have an opportunity. So in order to see the contours of what is only a snapshot of time on a piece of water or ground, especially if it's intertidal, take your digital camera and take shots of what you may well forget, so you can approach that water. So if you said, okay, fine, you've got to pick a coefficient tide, which is a tide which is lower than 1 meter on astronomical low. Some of those big tides in this area are 0.3s, only 30 centimetres above astronomical historical data. Take the shot and go and visit it, again, knowing where you should be presenting your line. Because the crease of water will allow you to know that the feature is there, but it might not show you exactly what you should be doing at any moment in time, so you can make reference to that. And we tend to find that there is definitely a productive time, and it's happened on the data that we've tabulated over the many years. Usually starts to pick up at about 1.5 hours. We work because we work a school. We've got to get you to the mark. We've got to get you kitted up. We've got to get you chilled out. We've got to then get your confidence up, and then we get you fishing. So the way that that works on the school is we get to a mark and we meet about 2 hours before low water. We normally hook up on ebb as well, as we're losing tidal flow. Okay, fish are moving out with food. We then get you in a position where you're chilled out, because you've got losing water around your ankles. We will then go and approach the water moving what could be if you're south face northing further south. So you're going to meet the fish at the narrowest point. And then you retreat with tide with me behind you. So I'm commanding you, hold, don't retreat too quickly. If you retreat too quickly, you're constantly in front of food that's coming in with fish. So a big guy, 6'8", don't get me wrong, has a marginal advantage because he's out there the longest. And if I'm 5'7" and I can definitely negotiate that stream, well, I guarantee you can as well. My job is to say no. You wait, you continue to work your lines. You come in, you retreat 10 foot at a time, until I say, now we're good to go, we need to move. So it's interesting because we don't work high water. So once you've isolated your ground, take your shots, try and interpret the data that those shots over time are going to give you. And then unfortunately, there's no easy way but to continue to put time into an area that you think may be productive. You'll then build a picture of scoring. You'll probably build a picture more than likely of not scoring, but data that is negative is still data, and I'm very numeric when it comes to plotting why I'm scoring, when I'm scoring. And there's definitely in our area, in certain marks that we work, there is definitely a trigger point on tide, and it used to happen, and it still happens actually, at +1.5 to +3 hours flood, which is the time the tide is building on flood. And in actual fact, on certain areas it works in exactly the same time when you're losing on ebb tides, but you have to put your time in to find that. So what would you do? I'd isolate an area that is being interrupted, that is being distorted, where tidal flow is artificially being created at a certain time on that tide. Take shots on low spring, interpret the data so you've got it in your back pocket. Don't take a flywheel with you the first time or the second time. Watch what the water flow does. And then slowly build up a visual interpretation of what you are doing when you cannot see the topography of the ground, and work the ground extremely comprehensively. Find yourself in a position which is safe. Always negotiate your transit point, so you might have to go through a few furrows to get to the area of ground which at that moment in time may be dry, so you get there for low water, waiting for food to come back onto you. Remember, once flooded, you cannot see those furrows. And a 6-inch furrow when you're belly button deep in surf is enough to put it over your weighted top. So what we do is we gauge our transit points on static data on the beach. So for instance, if I line up a lobster pot with, let's say, the last channel marker on the beach front or a groin, then that is my transit point at a certain amount of time. Don't do it with stuff that moves. Don't do it on a shingle bank or anything that could possibly be pushed over the course of a winter period, because the whole topography moves, maybe 50 or 60 feet in a season on a bad wind. So you have to have something which is anchored in order to get that transit point. And it takes a certain amount of balls actually to sit in an area knowing that you're deliberately cutting yourself off. Don't get me wrong, it's not for the faint-hearted. But what I would say is, tell someone where you are. Always retreat earlier rather than later. Be due diligent about what you do when you isolate a mark. There are a number of things. Once you've isolated your mark and you found that you think, oh, that looks a fairly sexy piece of water, let me take some digital shots of what that's showing to me. At that point, it gets more interesting and you've got to be more due diligent. Don't access water without knowing what time the tide is moving, okay? Absolute no-no. Remember, even a tide table is indicative of a prevailing southwesterly breeze, which is my area, at 5 knots. If the tide is kicking in 25 knots, it's going to come early. It's not going to come later. So your negotiating transit points are going to be earlier, and it's going to be a higher high water and maybe a lower low water on the big tides. So when it says 0.3, it's 0.3 when everything else is remaining equal. Ceteris paribus, nothing is changing at this moment in time if your natural environment is very stable. You've only got to move a couple of parameters for that maybe not to be the case. So I would always tell someone where I'm going to be, even to the point where I radiate to Solent Coast Guard now to say I'm isolating. If you get calls from mariners saying there are guys in an SOS signal, that's probably us double hauling, but it's nice to know that people are looking out for you in the first place. But don't be embarrassed about it. Tell people we're going to this area. Fish where with someone else. If you know that low water is at 6 a.m. in the morning and you get a rolling sea fog coming in and it comes in before you, or if that came in and you didn't know what time low water was, that would cause you a much bigger problem than it would do if you did know what it was. Because if it happened at 4 o'clock in the morning and you're accessing, I don't know, at the third week in June a mark and it's 4:30, it's light, you can work marks, and you know that you have an hour and a half of ebbing tide for that water volume to lose around your ankles, that's far more relaxing than not knowing exactly what the tide is doing. Some people turn around and say, which way is it moving? And how do you know? You've got a fog on you. You've only got to target a fish and turn around 180 degrees or another 270 degrees, hook one there, hook one there, hook one there, hook one. You turn around, you have no concept of where your horizon is. And sometimes, remember, you can move out to sea and it gets shallower. And you move back into the foreshore and it gets deeper, which is enough to spook you, because that's not the natural way around. Okay, so knowing when low water is absolutely imperative. So, yes, you need structured ground, or you need ground that is offering you, or the fish, an opportunity to trap bait. That's what I'm talking about. When I talk about fishing areas, it has to be in relation to, well, you want to interpret back to, okay, fine, what's happening with the food stream? What's happening with the bait stream? You wouldn't expect bass to be somewhere where it is not offered an opportunity. So what we're saying is, okay, fine, is an area able to offer a larder of food at a moment in time? And if the answer to that is yes, then you need to put time into it, because all bass do is follow food. And or they stage in areas which is offering an opportunity on food at a moment in time. And don't expect to be static. Many people sit there waiting for a fish to meet them. I would suggest you go meet the fish, because you're probably, I mean, there are many occasions where we've hooked into the same shoal of fish over 3 hours. We're moving with it, we're drifting with it. And a mark might offer a staging opportunity for a fish at 45 minutes flood that is no longer there an hour and a half, because the tidal flow is over the top of it. So it's not causing a crease of water or a confluence of water that is trapping food. That fish knows that and it moves to another area. So sometimes you can actually work with fish going into an estuary if you're working flood. And remember, the bigger the tides, the more you'll move. Okay, the smaller the tides, the less you'll be required to move. So it's a moving target, which makes it very difficult, unfortunately. It's not a black art. It's an interpretation of what is happening with the tidal flow of movement, the movement of food at any one moment in time. But yes, structured ground on spring tides. Another thing that we've noticed is that try and isolate in the early season areas which may well be covered over harder ground than softer ground. In the early season, when the water temperatures are increasing, and you can also get a short, sharp shock in May when you get frosts, the intertidal zone is as reactionary to losing condition or losing water temperature as it is to gaining it in the height of summer. So to work over an intertidal zone which is more rocky than, let's say, sandy, it will retain temperature much better. So what happens is on an ebb tide, it exposes the intertidal zone. If there's an amount of, let's say, hard shingle ground, you may well find it absorbs the temperature differential better and holds it better. So when it floods in, it effectively cooks the water and boils it. So you may well find that early season, fry, because fry are cold-blooded, are sitting in an area which is maybe 1.5 to 2 degrees warmer than the open sea. And they will herd into those areas, and a good quality fish that's returning knows where to hunt first. Any predator knows that, okay? It's instinctive for it to go to where food is going to be readily available. In exactly the same way, you may well find that if you're working over hard mud or sand, it loses temperature very, very quickly. I mean, what a reservoir trout fisherman might call a thermocline inversion. So you get a regressive water temperature differential throughout the water column, and suddenly you get polar air coming in on a front, and they go, oh, the fish have gone off feeding. They're not feeding, they've just gone lower. So put a high density line on and go into the thermocline where they were feeding. Which means you've got to be fairly mobile about your thought process. All fish do is feed and reproduce. So if they're not reproducing because it's April through to October and they've already reproduced, their primary motivation is to feed. And they have to feed. And that is one thing I think, you know, maybe the listener, although a very obvious point, it doesn't have the privilege of going to the fridge and having a bacon sandwich. It has to hunt constantly because it doesn't know when the opportunity is not going to arise again. And you can use that to your advantage. So using that as to your advantage, would they say, okay, fine, let's try and look for ground that is offering you an opportunity. So a canalised piece of water that has no structure on it may not be as conducive to hooking into a predator as an area where there's a confluence of water hitting landmass and deflecting off it, which may well trap bait. But remember, it only traps bait at a moment in time, and it will react differently at 1 hour, or plus 1 hour, to plus 2 hours, to plus 3 hours, and then over high water. So when I wrote my notes up after 5 or 6 years, I found that there was distinctly that correlation, and that's what's in the book. It's not... The book is a reference book for parameters that you are able to control, and you should be spending your time saying, I don't think that ground's going to be good enough, isolating a piece of ground, and then unfortunately sieving the water over the whole lunar cycle to the point where you build a very distinct picture in terms of when you're not hooking up. And it will be probably not very obvious at first, but unfortunately the only solution to that is trial and error.
And when you're fishing from the shore, is it wise then to carry a handheld GPS or VHF and still to wear a life jacket?
Well, certainly as a guide, yes. If I'm on the boat, I have regulations that are imposed on me in order to kit the vessel out with safety equipment. When walking, it's very much up to you, but I would never access the foreshore without a manual release 150 newton life jacket. They need to be manual because the automatics will go off with vapour, okay, and you look like the Michelin man when you're double hauling out there. It's happened, which is why we use the manuals. I have a radio on me. I have a mobile phone on me. I don't have a GPS on me. I know where I am. I think, certainly if I was accessing ground, I don't think I would access ground without being guided. I'm not saying being guided for a full week, but to say it, to get somebody who knows their ground well for a day, a morning or an afternoon or a full tide, I think is an absolute necessity and an asset. Not only in terms of safety, but in terms of, okay, fine, you know, let's interpret what I learned that day and then take yourself off yourself. But yes, safety gear is an absolute must. I still see people wading without safety equipment. If you're going to, you know, wear waders, wear a restrictive belt on your waders, which will restrict water ingress should you fall over, and people fall over. It's a fallacy that you get sucked down if you've got water in your waders. What happens is people generally panic, and what they should do is relax and float and put their boots up in the air, because it traps oxygen, which means you will float and you will go back somehow to, you know, you'll be intercepted by somebody. But what happens is people tend to try and tread water when they've got waders full of water, and you will build up very quickly the amount of lactic acid in your legs, which will prevent you from treading water, which eventually makes you sink and get sucked down. So the first thing to do is to try and just chill out a little bit and to assess. Now, that's easier said than done. It's not a nice thing when you have tidal flow on your case. And I would always say, and I think I said it sort of like half an hour ago, it usually happens when fish are on, funny enough. When fish are seriously busting up in front of you and you are highly reluctant to leave a mark that has suddenly shown you the full fruit bowl. But there's always tomorrow, and you're better off leaving the fish behind and maybe doubling back on yourself, getting back onto firm ground and intercepting which way the bait stream is going to get in front of the shoal again. It would be a mistake to push it to such an extent that you get wet, or you know, you have to somehow negotiate those furrows that are now 4 feet under. So my message to anyone starting is, be sensible. If you're going out on your own, tell somebody where you're going. Take a tide table with you. Kit yourself out with a manual release, hydrostatic release valve buoy that goes over your neck, and there are some good ones on the market that are very inexpensive, 30 quid, 35 quid, I'll buy you that, which will get you out of trouble if you get light on your feet. There's no point in talking and saying, oh, it's in the car, forgot it. At that point, and it happens when it happens very, very quickly. So veer on caution, be kitted up. The most important thing is you. An 80-centimetre bass is not worth that, don't get me wrong. And there's always tomorrow to go and approach the quarry on the same mark. And take it steady. That would be my message.
Picking up on the fact then that it's food over much of the summer that drives bass distribution, do you find early season when the crabs are molting that it doesn't pay to fish areas where crabs are going to be peeling due to the bass being preoccupied with them?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. I mean, a lot of people start chucking fluff at the sea in April and May, and you know, more often than not, you're going to fail. Well, in April and May and early June, you've got cuttlefish season on the south coast, which is a myriad of protein. All cuttlefish die after reproducing, and you've got a huge protein base of rotting flesh on the seabed. So, presented with that, I would say that you're going to be, and couple that up with lower water temperatures and higher water temperatures, you've got a readily available food source for a predator, and they're probably scavenging. And that season actually coincides with water temperatures building above 14 degrees. So above 14, 15 degrees, the body metabolism is increasing. The food source that was readily available in the cuttlefish season is gone and been eaten, scavenged, digested. And they start to motivate, without a doubt. So, yes, I mean, if you're looking at crab and shrimp and bits and pieces like that, I think there is distinctly... you can score very well in February and March in the harbour when the varans hatch. So if you get rag and lugworm hatches going on, which is a very early season injection of protein, you can suddenly find you've got a blitz on, which is very unusual for that time of year. But resident fish, fish which haven't migrated off, or for whatever reason have reproduced and have come in early, whatever reason it is, but if they're resident and they're there, you can see that. So, you know, to put some worm flies on, to figurevate those worm flies, or to hold those flies in suspension on a floating line with a leader length, which is allowing you to do that. Absolutely, you are effectively being asked to match the hatch of the marine environment.
Now, you've given us an insight into what could be good starting points or suitable areas to try. But what about unsuitable areas which may need to be avoided?
It's strange, actually. It's a very interesting question again, because this is where we sort of start coming into a three-dimensional sport. Some areas are more productive in certain states of tide at certain parts of the lunar cycle than others. So when you sort of start to where don't you bother, it's difficult. I would not bother if an area of water showed me no feature at all over a seven-hour tide on ebb and flood. I would say, well, ask yourself why you'd be there. Okay, so what you're going to try and look for is an angle on where food is being presented. And a flood mark at 2 hours might work tremendously well and then just die at 3¾ hours flood because the tidal flow has changed. And you may well find that a +3 hour flood mark doesn't have anything on it on the ebb at -3. Why would that be? Well, in order for tidal stream to be the same on ebb and flood, and in our area, you know, we flood east and we ebb west, you'd have to look at the analogy of if you put a 10 cubic metre granite stone in the middle of tidal flow, which was square on both sides, then you would expect the feature of current, if the current was the same, and it's not in our area because it's stronger on ebb as it is on flood, you'd expect if it was perfectly the same for it to show the same feature on the flood tide as it would on the ebb tide. However, if you sort of cut that cubic granite stone in half and made it into a right angle triangle, you're going to get tidal flow on the flat edge, on the right angled edge, than you would on the sloping side, which might explain why food holds there on a more aggressive structured side than a least aggressive structured side, if that explains that in that way. And the skill is only through a process of elimination, having failed so many times on an area that is presenting you with such great opportunity on one side of the tide. So it's a difficult question to answer, but certainly in areas that are just devoid of any feature, especially if you're walking, you might just find it looks like a homogeneous storm beach in Sussex. Well, even after you sat there and you know, had a picnic on the beach with your wife or your girlfriend or your kids, and you're using that as a sort of like a reconnaissance area to take digital shots of, and you think, oh, that's just totally flat and homogenous, maybe not bother with it. But bear in mind, you may well find that on a very homogenous, or say a beach that looks just very boring, if you get one or two features on it, don't ignore it, because in an area where that is more prevalent in terms of its structure is more homogeneous, you may well find it's the only area that fry holds on it. So the complete opposite occurs. A highly structured beach will dissipate food for it to be all over the place, and yet one area which might be a furrow that you think is, let's say, it's an area, is, look at a delta, you might get one very small stream on a very big tide that is 4 or 5 or only 6 inches deep. And you may well find, well, that's interesting. And you look either side of you, for 4 miles either side of you, there's nothing going on at all. You may well find that that is the only place you should be putting your time, when to the naked eye it looks exactly the same as everywhere else.
And now, the confidence side of things, because like anything new, you shouldn't expect to hit the jackpot immediately. It usually takes time to build up a true picture, but equally, you don't want to be investing time where it might obviously be wasted. What then would be the most striking features to grab your attention?
Water clarity is absolutely essential, okay? Without that, I think you're going to be pushing it anyway. Doesn't matter if it's the best mark in the world. I mean, water clarity for me is one of the biggest things that has to be on my side in order to feel good about either leaving the dock or wading the surf. I would look for a clean water column. I would look for an area that offered me an opportunity on tidal stream in order to position myself into an area that was being deliberately interrupted by landmass to give a cross current, which allows you to dead drift a fly, which is one of the most killing methods we got, i.e. no retrieve is the best retrieve. Once again, you're looking at food. So what happens in 3 or 4 knots of current? Food gets tied up in it. You don't expect an inch long fry of mullet to have any control in 3 to 4 knots of current. So for you to be stripping that at Mach 3 above upstream is probably looking quite bizarre to a fish. But for it to be caught in tidal flow might look a lot more natural. So, you know, once again, we're going into what you're looking for in terms of food and opportunities for food to be either housed or to be visiting at any one moment in time. So I think you've just got to be a little bit more perceptive about what an area is giving you. Also, there are some very visual opportunities that can present. It's necessary to have a certain amount of ornithology about you for a start. You know, the beach is alive. Certainly in our area, we've got little terns, and certainly the smaller bait is predated on by little terns and common terns and Arctic terns, this sort of stuff, which are the really, you know, they're fort-winged birds. And if you understand which birds are working in an area and they're very, very high above the water column, you're more than likely going to find that it's a little bit like a transducer on the stern of a boat. The higher the bird, the lower the bait. The lower the bird, the higher the bait. I.e. it's increasing its area of vision the higher it goes, and they've got exemplary vision. So if you've got a lot of birds working very low and they're almost swooping down and diverting their dive away from the water column, it's one of the biggest things that I've taught myself to do, because you can see a bass at maybe a mile. And people go, how the hell do you spot a bass at a mile? Well, you don't. You spot what's going on around the bass at a mile. And the best way to find out whether, because remember, a bird can be just taking bait off the water surface. Now, it could be a mackerel shoal that's pushed it up. It could be porpoises that have pushed it up. There might not be a predator there. But in order to find out whether a predator is there is to watch the bird that just diverts the dive away from the water column. And what it does at that moment in time, it's targeting a bait. It's just about to go in to take the bait out. And at the last second, it diverts the dive and reorientates and basically ascends again to retarget. Well, it doesn't go in the water column if it doesn't have a better than average chance of taking out what it's expending energy to take out. What you might find is a bass has just taken the bait right in front of it. At the moment the bird diverts the dive, it's shadowing the top water column with its wing beat, which if you're a predator, the predator interprets that as I'm getting taken out, and the bass will dive. If the bass dives, it leaves a boil on the surface, which mackerel don't necessarily do. I've never seen bass really jump, but they definitely do make holes in the water. And so, you know, you could be looking at birds diving, getting very excited, and you suddenly realise if you pan the water, you'll see breaks in the water column all over the place. Once you've done that, you need to then interpret which is the head and which is the tail of the shoal. In order to find that out, you've got to know which tide you're on, whether you're on an ebbing tide moving left to right or right to left. Once you've found which way the tide's working, you can intercept the flow of the food. Because if you didn't do that, you might get 4 or 5 shots into the tail, take 4 or 5 fish out of the tail, and then suddenly realise they've all gone through you. Whereby if you hit the nose, then you've got the whole shoal coming through you at any one time. It might offer you 5 or 6, 7, maybe 20 different opportunities before they've gone through you. So visually, be observant on the beach. Understand which birds are predating on what bait. Mainly terns on the intertidal zone. Small birds take small bait. Big birds take big bait. Once you've found birds, you've probably found food. No guarantee that food is being predated on by a submariner. Watch the water column in terms of seeing what happens. Then interpret that in terms of where you need to position yourself to have the best opportunity to intercept the tidal flow. That's what I would do.
And when out in the boat, do you always drift or might you occasionally anchor?
No, you never anchor. I have to have an anchor on a boat. I mean, I had a problem last week, you know, we had hydraulic failure on the boat. And I had to anchor down. No, I would much prefer to drift through an area and then use my slug lines on my C-120 Ray Marine to exactly gauge my drift. It plots your actual drift. You then circumvent the shoal again. You go round in a half-mile circle, not to disturb, you know, the shoal, and then you do it again. But yeah, what you're doing if you anchor, I can understand anchoring over structured ground, if you're using bait or you, you know, for bream fishing, for instance, is highly specific. Bass are moving. Generally, they're moving. Okay, they will be resident on an area over a certain amount of time, but generally, they're moving, and you move with them because the tide's moving. You have to divorce yourself from the way of thinking of a traditional bait fisherman or sea angler. You are using fly fishing equipment, and also I think that if you work with tide going with it, your lines work better. So for instance, you can imagine being anchored in one spot with four knots of current going below you. You're going to hard push yourself for 800 to 1000 grain line to get down because the tide will push it up. If you're going with it, technically the tide will work better for you if you're going with it. It will also look more natural. I sort of like made the analogy of stripping a small fly upstream at Mach 3, which you will be doing an awful lot of the time if you're anchored. Because you cut across the stream, you might mend a couple of times, and then you're going to be coming in up tide. So if you're working with it, you're actually allowing your kit to work and present itself in a much, much better way. So I, in order to slow me down even more, I use very big drogues on my boat if I'm not over foul ground. If I'm working in the harbour with people, I'm always using a drogue to slow myself down, to put you on those areas whereby you might get four or five opportunities to take four or five fish, and then we do it again. But yeah, an anchoring, no, I've never anchored.
If, as a guide, you're trying a new area, or perhaps there's someone out there trying to get into bass fishing on their own, is it advisable to initially adopt a systematic approach? And if so, what might that be?
Certainly a systematic approach is the only way to approach it. Once again, it's trial and error, isn't it? But what I would say is don't get to the mark on low water. Get to the mark before low water, for a start. So if you got there an hour and a half before low water, you're going to see the tide slowly losing momentum and offering you an opportunity of passage for a start. Because when it's all dry, you go anywhere, can't you? But when it's when you still have a neck of water that is becoming regressive, it's showing you what's left. It's showing you where not to walk, where you won't be able to get to, where you will be able to get to, but where you will be cut off at 45 minutes flood. So logically, I think it's safer to approach an area you're interested in fishing before the low water gauge and to see the environment drying out around you, which allows you to isolate the channels which on flood may give you a problem.
For more on the topic, parts 1, 3 and 4 cover an introduction to bass fishing, tackle and tactics, then bass and bass conservation respectively.